This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Other People's Houses by Abby Waxman. Read for you by Saskia Merleveld. 1. It was amazing how many children you could fit in a minivan if you tessellated carefully and maintained only the most basic level of safety. 4 in the very back, 2 of whom were painfully wedged in the space normally afforded to one child. A single lap belt over those 2. A choice both illegal and stupid, but there you go. And thank goodness they were skinny. Frances Bloom always had this vague belief that in the event of an accident, the pressure of all those little bodies would hold them in place. 10 seconds with a physicist would have cleared that up, but she didn't know any. And seeing as she rarely made it above 20 miles per hour in traffic, she might have been right. She was a careful driver, especially with other people's kids in the car, and so far she hadn't needed to put her nutball theory to the test. In the middle, the 2 littlest ones sat securely in actual car seats. And next to her in the front, holding sway over the CD player, with the attention to power and detail only a teenager could wield, her eldest daughter, Ava. 7 children, the genetic arsenal of 4 families. 1 big crash and the entire neighborhood would have had funeral scheduling issues. Not that it was a joking matter, of course. Frances just had these thoughts. What could you do? Rather than fight them and run the risk that they'd deepen her wrinkles, she just let the buggers run. She'd been doing this carpool for too long, she thought. It probably wasn't a good sign that a car crash sounded like just one of several options, rather than something to be avoided. But honestly, how many times could you break up a fight over the CD player, or who had to sit in the middle, or whether they could watch a DVD, which they couldn't, and never could have, even before the in-car machine broke? When it was a full house, like this morning, it got so raucous that a tribe of howler monkeys would have fallen silent in awed appreciation. Mind you, these were professional children, the offspring of creative people and deep thinkers who'd marveled over them as babies, encouraged them to express themselves as toddlers, and wished they'd been more consistent and mean to them now that they were old enough to sass back. In the far back seat, she had the 2 sibling children of her neighbors Anne and Charlie Porter, Kate and Theo. Lovely names, less than lovely children. Kate, 6, specialized in the surprise attack, and often sat silently through the entire trip, rousing herself only to shove her brother viciously out of the van at the other end. Theo, 10, never saw it coming. It wasn't that he was thick, per se. It was just that he never saw it coming. Theo himself preferred a full frontal physical assault, with optional screaming in the ears. God knew how that dynamic would play out in therapy. Interleaved between them, like 2 all-beef patties, were her son, Milo, who was 10, and his cousin, Wyatt, who was 6. They weren't really cousins, they were second cousins, or cousins once removed or something. Wyatt's mother was Iris, who was actually Francis's cousin, but it was just easier to call the kids cousins and have done with it. Wyatt reveled in the riches of 2 mothers. His other one was an actress famous for being America's honey. It wasn't a secret she was gay. It was just that America apparently didn't give a shit. Right behind her, where she could reach back and hand them stuff at the traffic lights, which she often did, were her youngest child, Lally, and her neighbor Bill's son, Lucas, both of whom were 4. It was a complicated carpool that had evolved over time. At first, the various parents had tried to take turns driving, but as Frances had a kid at every school, it quickly became clear it was just easier if she did it. She preferred it. She was the only parent who wasn't working. Let's not get into the atom splitting of who's doing more work, stay-at-home parents or not. Let's just agree it's a shit show for all of us and move on. So she wasn't trying to get anywhere herself, and often did the driving in pajamas. She also hated the feeling in the house just after the kids had screamed and yelled their way through getting ready, finding shoes and losing shoes, hunting down books and bags and hats and whatever, all of which they could have gotten ready the night before, not that she was making a point or anything, and had scrambled through the door and down the path to someone else's car. It made her feel like she'd been picked last for a team, or left behind at the train station, or like when she'd come home to an empty house after her own days at school. "I want to go too," her inner child cried. And her outer adult volunteered to do all the driving, and everyone was happy. The elementary kids got dropped off first, then Ava at her school, and then finally Lally and Lucas at the preschool, where they needed to be physically signed in. She would read a story, maybe two, then pause at the kissing window for a proper goodbye, with optional pretending she couldn't see her kid. "Where's Lally? Oh, there she is!" Jesus, did they ever get tired of that? Then she was free. Free to go to the store, free to go home, free to drive headfirst into the nearest wall, which was what she might have done if she didn't have to go back in 3 hours and pick up Lucas and Lally. Frances wondered how many other people were overwhelmed by anticlimax, but kept plodding along, taking care of their kids, picking up juice box straws so animals wouldn't choke on them, collecting corks or buttons or whatever craft supply was needed, replacing the batteries in the smoke alarm as soon as the first ping of complaint was registered. Maybe this was what they meant by staying together for the children. It had nothing to do with marriage at all. Frances pulled into the elementary school lot, and Ava got out, sighing as if she were a 14-year-old Victorian child disembarking for her day down the mine. She pulled open the door and swung her arm wide. "Medium-sized children may now escape. Mind the gap and watch out for speeding moms on cell phones." The children had already unbuckled and piled out, high-fiving Ava as they passed her. Kate stopped, and Frances turned to see what was up. The little girl's face was a study in conflict. "What's wrong, honey?" Kate looked at Frances and her chin wobbled. "I left my toilet roll tubes at home." "Oh." Frances looked at her eldest child. Ava shrugged, looking back inside the open minivan. "They aren't in the car." "Oh, okay." Frances smiled at Kate. "I'm sure the teacher will have lots of extras." She herself had, over time, sent in 3,000 toilet roll tubes. For all she knew, they were building a particle collider out of them, or an accurate recreation of the New York subway system. Let's hope they didn't use the obvious choice for subway trains. "No, I have to have my own ones!" Kate's eyes were filling with tears. Her shit-fit indicator was dropping to DEFCON 3. "It's for the class project! Everyone else will have them!" Frances weighed her options. On the one hand, Kate was only 6, and would not only survive, but would forget the trauma of not having had toilet roll tubes. But on the other hand, she was a member of the Yakuza-esque organization known as Miss Lolio's first grade class, whose members fell on the weakest like wolves on a lamb. Forgetting to bring toilet roll tubes and having to borrow some was a noticeable event to be avoided at all costs. It wasn't on the level of peeing oneself, of course. It wasn't going to give rise to a nickname you couldn't shake until college. But it wasn't great.
"My mommy put them in a bag, but she forgot to give them to me."
A note of accusatory steel had entered her voice. Frances gazed at the little angel, whose mother had been heard calling her Butter Blossom. Kate's eyes had gone flat like a shark's. She knew she would get what she wanted. The only question was when. "I am younger than you, old lady," her eyes said. "And I will stand here until age makes you infirm, at which time I will push you down, crunch over your brittle bones, and get the toilet roll tubes I need." "All right, Kate. I'll go back and get them after I drop Ava, okay? And bring them back to school for you." Frances knew she was being played, but it was okay. She was soft-hearted, and she could live with that. "Sucka." Ava headed back to her seat, shaking her head over her mother's weakness, a weakness she loved to take advantage of herself.
Thanks, Francis!
Kate beamed an enormous smile, turned and ran off. The transformation from tremulous waif to bouncy cherub instantaneous. Behind her in the line of cars, someone tapped their horn. Okay, the brief honk said. We waited while you dealt with whatever mini-crisis was caused by your piss-poor parenting, because we're nice like that. But now you can get a move on because we, like everyone else in this line, have shit to do. Amazing how much a second of blaring horn can communicate. Francis waved an apologetic hand out of the car window and pulled out of the gate. She dropped the other kids and was back at Anne's house in a half hour. Having carpool duty wasn't the onerous task the other parents thought it was. All three schools were close to home, and all four families lived on the same block. As Francis ran up to Anne's door, she looked over and saw her own cat, Carlton, watching her. She waved. He blinked and looked away, embarrassed for both of them. She knocked softly on the door, but no one answered. Maybe Anne had gone back to sleep. She turned the handle and pushed open the door, peering around. Yup, there was the bag of toilet roll tubes. She grabbed it and was about to shut the door again, when she saw Anne lying on the floor, her face turned away, her long hair spilling across the rug. Anne! Holy crap, are you okay? But as she said it, her brain started processing what she was really seeing. Anne on the floor, check. But now she'd turned her head, and Frances realized she was fine. In fact, she was better than fine. Frances had instinctively stepped over the sill, and now she saw that Anne was naked, her face flushed, a man between her legs, his head below her waist. Shit! Frances dropped her eyes, began to back out. Sorry, Anne. Kate forgot her toilet roll tubes. Stupidly, she raised her hand with the Whole Foods bag in it, because, of course, that would make it better, that she'd interrupted Anne and Charlie having a quickie on the living room floor. It was okay, because she was just here for the toilet roll tubes. Nothing to see here. Move along. The man realized something was wrong, finally, and raised his head, looking first at Anne and then turning to see what she was looking at, why her face was so pale when seconds before it had been so warmly flushed. Francis was nearly through the door. It was closing fast, but not before she saw that it wasn't Charlie at all. It was someone else entirely. 2. Anne closed her eyes and shivered. Francis had let in a draft, along with the potential end of the world. The younger man laid his cheek on her upper thigh and smiled ruefully up at her.
I'm going out on a limb here and guessing you didn't want that person to see me.
Anne shook her head, shifting her weight and pulling her legs out from under him, drawing them up, covering herself. No. Although of all the people who could have walked through that door, she was the least disastrous.
Your friend, not his?
She shrugged. She's both of our friend, but she won't say anything to him. She might not even say anything to me. She noticed he still had an erection, bless his youthful stamina. If she'd been young herself, she would have felt an obligation to blow him. But those days were long gone.
Are you sure she saw me?
Richard was still hoping this session could get back on track, and tried kissing her knee. Maybe he could get a consolation blowjob. She frowned at him, stood, turned, reached for the dressing gown she'd been wearing when he had walked in. They hadn't made it any farther than the living room floor. It had been a long time apart. If they'd gone upstairs, their secret would still be safe, Anne thought. But she felt queasy about fucking this guy in her marital bed. Not that the marital bed saw much fucking, but still. Richard, watching her face now that her body was covered, wondered for the thousandth time what this woman was thinking.
She confused and worried him. He was so drawn to her, even though he knew what they were doing was total karma suicide. The one female friend he'd told, a woman he used to date in college, but who'd turned into a much better friend than girlfriend, lost her temper with him for the first time in years.
She has children?
Richard clearly remembered the look of disgust on her face. He'd tried to laugh it off.
I'm not asking her to leave them. It's just an affair.
His friend knew better and wasn't appeased.
It will end in disaster. It can't possibly end any other way. I can't believe you're being so selfish for sex. You're not 17, for fuck's sake. Can't you keep it in your pants?
Richard looked at Anne now, or her back at least, as she left the room. She had twisted her dark brown hair into a knot, literally tying it within its own length. It was magical to him, watching her do things like that. He had wanted this woman from the moment he'd met her, in the fevered way he remembered from high school, when just proximity to a girl was enough to make him hard. He had thought he was long past that phase. He was an adult. He paid taxes. He had a job. He had lived with a woman for 3 years, bought her tampons, talked to her through the bathroom door while she took a crap, watched her dress and undress morning and night. He was getting ready for marriage, he could tell. God knew his mother was starting to bug him for grandchildren. But then that relationship had ended, almost by accident, as if they'd dropped a baton somewhere and run farther and farther apart before they noticed. The lack of emotion when she moved out was embarrassing. But then he'd met Anne at an art store, where both of them wanted the last piece of a special handmade paper. They'd started friendly, both offering the piece to the other. Then he'd prevailed and made her take it, and they'd stood outside the store and talked about art. And when she'd smiled at him, he was aroused. He was good with women. He was handsome and artistic and somewhat remote. He'd rarely been turned down. But when he'd asked for her number, she had laughed, blushed, and refused. She was married. She had kids. She'd even mocked him gently for asking out a woman who could have been his mother. Though that was far from true. Less than a decade separated them. He'd persisted, and suddenly possessed by a madness he'd never suspected in himself, told her the truth. That he wanted to take her to bed and drive her mad with pleasure. That he'd never seen a woman so beautiful before. That his apartment was 4 blocks away and no one would know. No one would ever know, Anne. Come with me now and give in. Let me tangle my hands in your hair and make you gasp and shudder. And Anne, so used to being sad that she didn't even see beyond the end of each day, said yes. Walking into his small apartment had been like pushing her way through fur coats in a closet and coming out in Narnia. She left herself behind, and Richard saw an Anne no one else ever had. For him, this whole affair was unreal. A liminal period like a hangover, or the days between Christmas and New Year's. Intense sex, interspersed with long silences and days where Anne took her kids to Disneyland, bickered with her husband, made meals that everyone took for granted, tried on clothes that suddenly fit her again, decided to end the affair and then picked up the phone to call him one more time. All he knew were the sex and the silences, of course, though he wondered about the rest. He could hear her now in the kitchen. He reached for his clothes, scattered on the floor, and started to dress himself. Maybe Anne was making coffee, her slender fingers efficient. Maybe she was splitting open a brioche with just one twist and getting out the jam. Or maybe she was slitting her wrists with one of those fancy ceramic knives she liked. His throat tightened, and he hopped slightly, tugging on his jeans. In the kitchen, Anne reached for the coffee and wondered what Richard was doing in the other room. Getting dressed, hopefully. Seeing Francis had thrown her so badly, all she wanted was for him to leave. She opened the coffee bag, cursing when the little wire and paper thing that held it shut fell off. Why do they even make that kind of bag? where the wire and paper thing was glued on. She much preferred the other kind, where the wire was part of the bag. Integrated, integral, whatever. This kind, the thing inevitably fell off, and then you couldn't close the bag. Eventually, when you opened the cupboard one morning, when things didn't seem able to get much worse, the bag would tip onto the counter, flipping in mid-descent, dumping the coffee grounds onto the counter, onto the floor, where you would track them all over the house, and they would work their way into the carpet like poppy seeds in your teeth. She tossed the broken bag, three-quarters full, in the trash. "Let's just avoid that disaster," she thought to herself, her mouth turning up a little, despite the tightness with which she was holding it closed. Richard came up behind her, his hand smoothing the silk dressing gown over her hips, his fingertips folding around her hip bones possessively. She felt different from the younger women he'd slept with. She wasn't perfect. She had broader hips, despite her narrow waist, and her butt wasn't firm from the gym. But he craved her, dreamt about her every night, wanted right then and there to bend her over the counter and finish what they'd started in the living room. Anne twisted away from him gently. Pouring half and half into her coffee, she raised an eyebrow to ask if he wanted some. He shook his head.
"I guess I should be going, right? I'm getting that sense."
Anne wondered how she would explain him to Francis. Clearly, Richard was gorgeous and young and sexy, that part cliched and obvious. But that wasn't what drew her to him, although it might have been easier to explain it that way. She liked how he talked, the different vocabulary, the occasional pop culture reference she missed, the otherness. He was interested in what she had to say, found her novel and wise, valued her experience. It didn't hurt that he constantly wanted her, or that when she ran out of things to say, she could lose herself in sex. Charlie, her husband, loved her dearly, but in the way one loves a sibling, with all the wrinkles and scabs those relationships have. If she made a joke, he'd heard it. If she wore something new, he noticed, but wondered if it had been on sale. Richard thought she was fascinating. Charlie thought she was competent and strong. Richard wanted to go down on her, to immerse himself in her body, to put his fingers inside her and then suck on them, grinning. Charlie was fine to wait until another night. "No problem, babe. No, I understand. Let's snuggle."
"I think you should go now, yeah. I'll text you or something."
She held her mug of coffee tightly. World's best mom. He left by the back door, and she'd turned away before he was even out of the garden. 3. Frances was amazed to discover her legs were propelling her in the usual fashion as she walked down the street toward her own house. Birds appeared to be singing, the sidewalk wasn't opening underneath her, and her cat was still standing where he had been 20 seconds earlier, washing his tail. She herself felt lightheaded and woozy, as if gravity wasn't working so well, or she'd accidentally had 4 shots of Jägermeister.
"Hey, Frank!"
Startled, Frances looked up to see her cousin Iris crossing the street toward her, glowy from the gym.
"Drop-off go okay? Did Wyatt behave himself?"
"Of course!"
Her voice worked, too. It was astounding.
"He was the sweetheart he always is."
She was going to be able to have a conversation without blurting out what she'd just seen. Such casual perfidy.
"For you, he is. For us, he's the spawn of Satan.
Maybe you should have looked more closely at the donor profile.
You think?"
Iris grinned.
"Maybe Nicodemus wasn't the 6-foot Irish-American hottie and geologist he claimed to be?"
"Yeah.
My hobbies include collecting minerals like sulfur and brimstone, sharpening my scythe, and propelling souls into eternal damnation.
It's important to read the whole thing." Iris laughed. She was tall and blonde, with strong features. She and Frances had grown up together, essentially, because their mothers were sisters who lived 4 blocks from each other on the Upper West Side of Manhattan.
When Iris and Sarah, then a struggling actress making the occasional TV commercial, moved to L.A., they'd encouraged Frances to come too. When a house on the same block was about to come on the market, Iris had called Frances and told her to jump on it. She and Michael left everything behind and made the move, and had yet to regret it. Today might be the day, of course. Are you okay? Iris looked at her cousin closely. Frances thought about telling her, because it would feel so good to just blurt it out and split the headache. But then she realized she couldn't. She had no idea why Anne was fucking around on Charlie. Couldn't understand why she would threaten her entire existence by doing so. But until she'd spoken to her, she couldn't tell anyone else what she'd seen. It was the omerta of friendship. I'm fine. Just tired as usual. How can you tell? Iris hugged herself. Aren't you always a little bit tired? Frances smiled tightly, and Iris added, Why don't you go home and grab a quick nap? Don't you have a little time before you go back to pick up Lally? Yeah, that's probably a good idea. Frances gave her cousin a hug and carried on to her house. Iris stood and watched her go, wondering what was up. She shrugged inwardly. It would all come out in the end, whatever it was. It always did. When Frances opened the front door, her house phone was ringing. The mechanical voice said, Call from Anne Porta. Call from Anne Porta. I'll bet it is, muttered Frances, suddenly furious. Fuck you. She started unloading the dishwasher, letting the machine pick up. It's Anne. Please come talk to me. Click. Fuck you again, I say, thought Frances, calmly placing mugs upside down in the glass-fronted cabinet. Fuck you very much for ruining my carefully constructed life in which all my friends are just as happy as I am, where we are going to do it better than our parents did, are going to be happy and raise our kids without ambivalence and frustration. Fuck you for peeling the lid off the can of worms, you selfish, selfish bitch. The phone rang again. Frances clicked her tongue and suddenly picked it up. It's Anne. Yes? Can we talk? Yes. You have to come here, though. I'm cleaning up. Okay. Okay. See you soon. After you shower the cum off your legs, you whore. Bye. Anne hung up. Frances put the coffee machine on and checked for cream in the fridge. She pulled out cookies and put some on a plate. She swept crumbs into a pile at the center of the table and then onto her cupped palm, throwing them in the sink. She finished unloading the dishwasher and reloaded it. She put cereal boxes back in the cupboard from breakfast and wiped the counters. She straightened the chairs around the kitchen table. She checked again for cream in the fridge. She went to pee, and when she looked at herself in the bathroom mirror, she saw her mother's face looking back at her. Anne held the mug Frances always gave her, a souvenir Anne had brought back from Venice one year. The blue and white stripes and the red scarf of the gondolier always looked so cheerful. Anne looked at the plate of cookies. Did you make these? Frances nodded. Anne reached for one out of habit. Drop off, go okay? Frances nodded again. Apart from the toilet roll tubes incident? Yes, let's talk about the toilet roll tubes. Yeah, I put them out, but I guess she forgot to grab them. Thanks for coming back for them. Thanks for ruining my secret. No problem. Of course, I didn't take them to your kid yet. I sort of got derailed. I haven't decided yet whether she needs to suffer for your sins. Silence. Another cookie. They'd been friends for about 5 years, since Iris and Sarah had introduced them. They'd always gotten on well,
both having the same interests, their children, their houses, their marriages, their hopes and dreams, their Pinterest boards. They weren't truly close. They were friends of proximity, friends because their kids were friends, and because of the carpool. If they saw each other in the street, they would stop and hug, check in, plan to have lunch, and maybe twice a year they would. They would describe each other as friends, do each other significant favors, but if one of them moved away, they would promise to keep in touch, and not. But hey, look at them now. Now they were bound together in a whole shiny new way. Francis took a sip of coffee. So, how long have you been sleeping with a total stranger? Anne shrugged. 6 months. Her tone was even, as if Francis had just asked a follow-up question about the toilet roll tubes. I assume Charlie doesn't know?
No.
Are you in love with him?
Charlie?
The stranger.
His name is Richard.
I don't give a shit what his name is, Anne. Do you love him?
No.
Then why, if you don't mind my asking, are you risking your children's happiness in order to have sex with him?
Frances's face was flushed, her eyes bright with tears. Anne looked at her and felt irritated by her judgment, even though she genuinely liked the other woman, trusted her completely, and could see how much she was hurting.
I have no idea.
Don't you love your kids?
More than anything.
Well, you apparently don't love them enough to not sleep with this person and run the risk that Charlie will find out, be devastated, divorce you, fight you for child custody, and make them choose between the two of you.
Frances stood up to go refill her mug, in order not to smash it into Anne's calm, elegant, beautiful face. Anne's serenity had been one of Frances's favorite things about her. She'd always marveled at the other woman's composure, and wished for one-tenth the gravitas Anne had. Frances suddenly wondered if it was a mental deficiency or sociopathic disorder. Maybe Anne looked at everyone as if they were chairs or something, unable to feel any empathy at all.
Frances turned to face her friend. Why am I so completely upset by this and you're not? Are you having some kind of mental breakdown? I thought you and Charlie were happy together.
We are.
Frances laughed. The doorbell rang. Sarah Gillespie, the wife of Francis's cousin Iris, was sufficiently famous that people would stop her in the street. Not so famous that she couldn't walk down the street, but still, frequently recognized. She always played the slightly ditzy but cute-as-a-button girl next door, doomed to romantic failure until the right night came along, her optimism and open-heartedness about to be lost forever when, poof, Mr. Charming realized he couldn't live without her and asked her to marry him. She was smart, and alternated blockbuster rom-coms with sharp and sarcastic indie pictures that didn't make money but won awards. She rarely gave interviews, and only went on TV to support charities or raise awareness of some atrocity somewhere. People knew she was gay. It had never been a big secret. But they were able to overlook it or something. Maybe the world accorded her the privacy and respect it wanted for itself. There was always hope. Sarah just shrugged it off. And as she walked into Frances's kitchen now, she was laughing at the magazine she held in her hand.
It says here, oh, hi, Anne, that I'm leaving Iris for this guy, whoever the fuck he is, and that I've decided I'm straight after all.
She bent to kiss Anne on the cheek, and then snagged a cookie.
Am I interrupting something interesting? You both look very serious.
No, not at all.
Anne smiled at her.
We were just talking, you know.
Oh, good. I'm glad you're here, because I came to get Francis's advice, and you can chime in, too. I want to throw a surprise party for Iris for her birthday, and I wondered what you thought.
She sat on the edge of the table, one of her signature traits. She would leap onto a counter or sit on the floor cross-legged, or flip a chair around and straddle it.
but it was only under duress that she'd sit straight on a regular chair in a regular way. Frances was making her a cup of coffee.
At the house?
Maybe. What do you think?
Sarah rubbed a hand over her short, curly blonde hair, expensively cut and tousled to look as if she'd just gotten out of bed. She spent time on her appearance. It was her job, after all. And it took a lot of money and effort to look as if she didn't.
Why not? I think it would be fun.
What kind of party? Formal evening-y or daytime kidsy?
Sarah took the coffee Frances was holding out to her and another cookie.
These are awesome cookies. Low fat, right?
She grinned and then answered Frances' question.
I was thinking it might be fun if it seemed sort of impromptu at first, and then gradually revealed itself as a planned thing.
The other two were frowning, so she clarified.
Imagine, if you will, a simple lunch with Frances, Michael, and the kids. They come over, bearing a birthday cake that Frances has deliciously baked, and I have made a plate of sandwiches and salad-y stuff. Trader Joe's, nothing fancy, right? Happens all the time.
She grinned.
But then, the doorbell rings and it's Anne, Charlie, and their kids. And hey, who knew, they brought some food too. And somehow I find another plate of sandwiches from somewhere, or maybe a veggie platter, who knows. And then the doorbell rings again and it's Maggie and Melanie and they brought wine. And then, you get my drift. Eventually everyone would be there. And after a bit she'll realize that it was all a plot. And that way, I don't need to do an elaborate ruse to get her out of the house.
She looked thrilled with herself.
Frances nodded. I think it sounds great. I'm in for sure.
Anne frowned.
But then we won't have that great surprise moment.
Sarah shook her head.
Iris hates being surprised like that, hates it. This way, I can spring something on her without worrying that she'll have a coronary or react badly. It's her birthday, after all.
Yeah, added Frances dryly, looking at Anne with no expression.
Not everyone likes the feeling that people have been plotting behind their back.
Right,
Sarah giggled.
And I can hide food at your houses, right?
Sure, it will be easy. And I thought I'd have a bouncy house arrive in the middle, so the kids will be entertained.
Nice.
Yay, good. Then that's settled. Now all I have to do is prevent myself from spilling the beans in the next few weeks, and we'll be fine.
She slid off the table, grabbed another cookie, and hugged them both.
How is it you eat so many cookies and stay thin? I kind of hate you.
Anne was smiling as she said this. And as Frances watched Anne pretend to be normal, to have normal friendships, and to care about people, while making chatty conversation, she suddenly felt exhausted, like week four of a new baby exhausted.
Sarah looked surprised. I'm going to go home and vomit up the whole lot. Isn't that what everyone does?
Frances laughed.
No, I hide them in special carrying cases I have on my upper thighs.
Ah, well, that's another way to go.
Frances walked Sarah to the door and watched her make her way down the street, her energy causing her to essentially skip. No wonder she stayed thin. Her whole life was a minor workout. Frances propped the door open to bring in some air and went back to the kitchen. 4. Earlier, after Iris watched Frances walk into her house, she turned and looked up the street for a moment. No Sarah. Frowning, Iris had headed indoors, wondering what was keeping her wife. Sarah had been gone very early, to do some voiceover fix or something, but was supposed to come home for brunch. Iris had run out after Frances had picked up Wyatt, to go to spin class and then to get the cinnamon rolls from Acme that Sarah loved. Whatever. She was used to Sarah's occasional flakiness. Okay, frequent flakiness. She herself had a meeting at noon, but there was plenty of time. Her work was only half-hearted anyway, if she were being honest with herself. She mostly had meetings to prove she could still get people to meet with her, that she hadn't become invisible.
Hello, Roscoe,
The dog was beside himself to see her, his tail a barely visible whir of excitement. She stooped to scratch his ears, smooth his small head. He was a mutt, with a comical level of mismanagement in the continuity department. A small head like a fox, a cylindrical body like a dachshund, legs like a terrier, and the tail of a golden retriever. It was a look that didn't quite work, unfortunately. It wasn't so much cute as the island of Dr. Moreau. But Iris had seen him in the pound and knew immediately that this was the dog for her. He looked vaguely embarrassed that his outsides didn't match his insides, and she knew how that felt. She paused. Was that Sarah's car? It stopped short, didn't turn into their driveway, so she shrugged and went into the kitchen, Roscoe at her heels. First coffee, then the dishwasher, then the laundry. The familiar 1-2-3 of every single morning. Like many of the lesbian couples she knew, things were at least theoretically egalitarian. They shared the work. Except that theory was one thing and practice another. When Sarah was busy, Iris would pick up the slack. But somehow the favor was never returned, and when Sarah's schedule loosened up, not all of the slack got taken back. Sarah was supposed to empty the dishwasher. Iris would refill it. Sarah was supposed to do the laundry. Iris would put it away. It all made sense, and yet none of it was happening these days. Iris liked things to be clean, wanted to see uncluttered surfaces, items filed away. She worked efficiently, emptying, refilling, wiping counters, doing a sweep for stray dishes, topping up rinse aid, soap, hitting buttons and slamming the door. Then she stood and drank her lukewarm coffee, looking out at nothing. The house was silent, so quiet she could hear a clock upstairs ticking away the hour. She supposed she looked calm and composed, but inside she was going slowly insane because she wanted another baby and Sarah didn't. She'd brought it up, but Sarah had shrugged and said she thought things were great right now. Why fix something that wasn't broken? And the subject was dropped. Iris wasn't entirely sure why she wasn't pushing it, but she wasn't. Iris rinsed her coffee cup, pausing the machine to put it in. Steam wafted out, along with that hideous smell of newly heated old food and salty water. So she held her breath and turned away as her hand found a space for the cup. She couldn't stop thinking about a baby. Sarah, for her part, was happy Wyatt was at an age where she and Iris had more freedom. "Thank goodness we can sleep all night now," she would say, or, "Isn't it nice we can just leave him with a sitter and go out?" And Iris would nod and agree, because those things were nice, she did appreciate them. And yet she wanted another child with a visceral pull that, however hard she tried, was just getting more and more insistent. She cried whenever she got her period, and went to the back of her closet to hold the tiny clothes she'd hoarded from when Wyatt was a baby. Sarah thought she'd given them away, and some she had. A good friend of hers had gotten pregnant accidentally when her husband was vacillating about a third child, and Iris was bitter that option wasn't open to her. Conceiving Wyatt had been a whole mishigosh that took weeks of preparation, lawyers for all sides, thermometers and doctor's offices. She had been up for the turkey baster in the bedroom method, but Sarah wanted the certainty of medical intervention. Sarah had been very gung-ho for a child. She'd been thrilled when Iris was pregnant and showed ultrasounds around on the set and generally looked forward to their expanding family. But now she was done. She was happy. And if she knew that Iris ached to be pregnant again, to have another baby to care for, she didn't show it. "Roscoe, do you think it would be possible for Wyatt to occasionally pick up a toy?" Roscoe remained silent, though he looked supportive. Iris sat on the floor of Wyatt's room and threw toys into various buckets and baskets, artfully arranged around the perimeter. Sarah had hired a great decorator for Wyatt's room, and it was Land of Nod catalog ready, with that additional element of surprising hipness Sarah loved. Iris had grown up surrounded by mess and disorganization, her mother an exhausted working mom with four kids and a charming but feckless husband. Iris had spent a lot of time at Francis's house as a kid, because there was more room for her there with only two kids. Then, Francis's brother had died at 14, struck down by a mysterious flu and dead 48 hours after he first said, "Mom, my head really hurts." After that, things reversed, and Francis spent more time at Iris's house than she did at home. Francis's house had become too quiet, her parents literally struck dumb by their pain. Iris envied her own son the many toys and clothes and space he had, the beautiful colors and prints of his sheets, the charm of his rugs and painted walls. At the same time, of course, she was happy he had it all, wanted his whole existence to be well-coordinated and whimsically decorated. Where the hell was Sarah? When Sarah left Francis's house, she knew she'd exited some kind of scene in progress, but she couldn't work out what it was. Dismissing it as nothing to do with her, she crept around the back of her own house, hoping to surprise Iris. She spotted her through the kitchen window and ducked down behind a bush, giggling. She loved her wife so much. After nearly 20 years together, she still felt glad to see her every time. All she wanted was for Iris to be happy, for her to know how much she appreciated her. As she peered between the leaves like a burglar or a baby deer, she was surprised to see Iris looking a little blue, just staring into the distance, drinking her coffee. Who knew what she was thinking? Maybe she was considering going back to work full-time. She'd seemed preoccupied lately, and Sarah thought maybe she was planning a return to her career. Iris had been a writer's agent at one of the major talent agencies in town, very successful and glamorous, high-profile clients and dinners every night. When Sarah first broached the idea of having kids, she was certain Iris wasn't going to be into it, but she'd been all for it. Once Wyatt had started school, Iris had begun doing odd projects here and there. But now, of course, she might be ready to go back to work full-time. Raising a kid was pretty thankless, and Sarah wasn't always sure Iris loved it. She herself hadn't turned out to be as maternal as she'd expected, but hey, life is full of surprises. She briefly pondered her feelings about Iris going back to work, and was surprised it made her sad. She liked being able to take everyone with her when she had to do a longer shoot. Even though she knew eventually Wyatt would need to stay in school all the time, she liked the freedom to be nomadic and artsy and bohemian. If Iris went back to work, that would stop, presumably. Shit. Iris had left the kitchen and headed off somewhere. Sarah crept in through the back door and stalked her on pussycat feet. She came upon her in Wyatt's room, talking to Roscoe, who unfortunately ruined her surprise entrance by standing up and waving his flaggy tail. Iris turned. "There you are. I was starting to feel stood up." Sarah bent down and kissed her wife's hair. "You smell good. I see you and Roscoe are working as a team." Roscoe banged his tail on the ground, grinning up at her. "You're joking. Roscoe was taking the toys out as fast as I can put them away. He's no use at all." Iris stood, and Sarah pulled her into a hug. "Do you want to go out for brunch?" Iris shook her head. "No, I got cinnamon rolls." "From Acme?" Sarah's tone was hopeful. Iris nodded, and Sarah squeezed her. "You are a wicked, wicked woman. It's going to be pilot season soon, and everyone will cast me as the plump friend." "Well, better that than the bitter single friend. That one doesn't suit you at all." Sarah laughed and watched Iris walk away from her down the hall. She still loved looking at her. She was so strong and curvy. Maybe she could talk her into bed. There were no kids around, thankfully. When Wyatt had been young, there had been months, literally months, when they didn't have sex at all. Now they had plenty of time, and often plenty of interest. But she'd missed her chance. Iris was already halfway down the stairs, and moving in a way that told Sarah she was distracted. It was remarkable how much you could tell about someone's state of mind purely by looking at the way they put down their bag at the end of the day, or by the sound of a door closing. or even by how long it took for them to walk into the house after you heard the beep of the car alarming itself. You become an anthropologist studying a tribe of one. And then if you have kids, you start studying them too. But they're harder because the little bastards are studying you right back and changing and growing in a frustrating step function of leaps, bounds, and backward stumbles. Of course, maybe this was also an actor thing, because the semiotics of emotion were tools to her. Little hand gestures barely caught by the camera could make the difference between a visible performance and the true inhabiting of a character. Sarah looked down. Roscoe was looking up at her uncertainly. He wanted to follow Iris, but it had seemed rude to do so while Sarah was standing there. He waved his tail gently. She grinned at him. "Sorry, dear. I just drifted off there." She headed downstairs to find her wife. 5. Back in Francis's kitchen, there was a long silence after Sarah left. "Are those the toilet roll tubes?" Anne gestured to what was clearly a bag of toilet roll tubes. "No," thought Francis. "Those are the global thermonuclear devices I was planning on planting all along Larchmont Boulevard, the ever-so-slightly twee shopping street nearby." "Yes. Apparently Kate faces instant expulsion from the cool kids if she doesn't have them." Frances looked at her watch, surprised to see it wasn't quite 10. How could so much be destroyed in less than an hour? "Do you think it's too late?" Anne got up, rinsed her coffee cup, and went to pick up the bag. "To drop them off?" Frances shook her head. "No, they have circle time first, then pointless worksheets, then lunch. I don't think they do crafty shit till the afternoon." She picked up cookie crumbs with her thumb and licked them. Anne shrugged. "Okay, then. I guess I'll run these over." "Your boyfriend left, I assume?" "Yes." "I'm sorry if I ruined the mood." Frances kept an even tone as she stood and went to put her cup in the sink, although it was clear she didn't give a rat's ass about the mood. Anne turned and walked toward the door. "No problem. He'll be back. Or he won't, who knows." Frances followed her. "Why are you being so cavalier about it? You know you're going to get caught, don't you?" Anne paused, searching her friend's face. "Are you going to tell Charlie?" Frances shrugged. "No. He's not my husband." "Are you going to tell Michael?" "Of course. He is my husband." "Do you think he'll tell Charlie?" "I have no idea. Anne, you've been on the planet for over 4 decades. You read books, you watch the news. You should have anticipated getting found out, because it always happens. It always happens, Anne. And you knew that going in. You just didn't care." Anne opened the door and stood there for a moment. "It's not that I didn't care, it's that I've lost my mind. I really think I've gone insane. I don't feel anything anymore. It's just a blank white sheet. And the worst part is I don't even care that I don't care. I don't miss feelings at all." She turned and looked at Francis with cool, tearless eyes. "Horny is the only emotion I've felt for the last 6 months." Francis was cutting. "Horny isn't an emotion, Anne. It's a glandular condition of the young, which you are not. Depression isn't an emotion either, but many people find therapy and medication a lot more effective than having sex with a college student." "He's not a college student. He's a teacher at the art college." "I don't give a shit what he is, Anne. It's not like I'm ever going to be his friend." A neighbor walked by with her small dog, looking over at the raised voices. Anne and Frances both nodded and waved, and the neighbor nodded back, then paused for an awkward moment while her dog peed on the lawn. She made the classic eye roll that said, "Sorry, my dog's peeing on your grass. What can you do? I can hardly drag him off, trailing piss across the sidewalk." And the two women at the door smiled and waited.
as the lady moved off, Anne suddenly sighed and walked away, and Francis turned and shut the door. Back to work, everyone. Nothing to see here. Across the street, Bill Horton looked up at the sound of a door slamming. Anne Porter was walking away from Francis Bloom's house, carrying a bag of something. He watched her, noting the cool way she moved, the slenderness of her figure accented by the simple jeans and loose sweater she wore. She was one of those women you couldn't help noticing, whatever the context. They came in all shapes and sizes, these women, the women he mentally labeled alluring. It was an old word, a word his father would have used, but it worked. All women could be attractive. Many women were sexy. Lots and lots of them were appealing and intelligent and funny and loving. But only a select few were like Anne. Unreachable. And, he mentally shrugged, alluring. Now she was getting into her car, her hand on the top of the door, the last thing he saw. Her slender wrist torquing as she lowered herself suddenly filled his mind with the thought of seeing that wrist against a pillow as he pushed himself into her. Her car pulled away, carrying the image with it. He sat back from his desk and laughed at himself. In his 40s, currently separated from a woman less timeless than Anne, but much warmer, he hadn't had sex for nearly a year, and sometimes the teenage boy who lived in his dick appeared. He didn't even like Anne very much. There was something mocking that went along with her elegance. But you didn't need to like a woman to imagine fucking her. He wondered how different human history would have been had evolution selected for that. The phone rang, and he knew immediately it was his wife, Julie. Right now they were apart, but for Bill the separation was only physical. Hello, you. Her voice was lovely as ever. It might have been the thing he missed most about her. He'd always loved listening to her talk. To him, to the guy at the grocery store, to their son, even to their lawyer. Deep and melodious, with a laugh always buried somewhere inside it. It was what he'd been attracted to first. He'd heard her talking to someone else behind the library shelves, and managed to wander around in time to see her. He'd found himself staring at books about accountancy, hoping she would notice him. She had.
Hello yourself,
he replied now, a dozen years later, still in love. How's today? Bill frowned, trying to remember.
Fine. Francis took him off to school. I'm working on 24 seconds of music to go behind a dancing... Hang on...
He looked on his desk for a piece of paper.
A dancing Danish.
Danish what?
No, just Danish. The pastry.
His wife laughed, then coughed.
What is it dancing about? Is it happily dancing because it's thrilled by its frosting? Or is it drunkenly dancing alone in the liquor aisle?
Is your cough worse?
No. Tell me about the Danish. Bill sighed. If she didn't want to talk about something, she wouldn't. That was the way with her. She was like a cat, his wife, in many ways. Mysterious, beautiful, happy to be alone. And totally disinterested in pleasing anyone else unless she wanted to. Not in a mean way at all, but in a way that didn't expect anyone to do anything for her either. He felt a mild frisson of anger, but ignored it. They'd fought hard for a long time, and now they were trying to keep the peace. He certainly wasn't going to be the one to throw the first stone.
The people at the agency didn't give the Danish a backstory. The brief is simply this. The music cue is 24 seconds long, should have a polka rhythm, and suggest energy and happiness.
Julie snorted.
Well, that's plenty of background. The Danish enjoys polka music. The Danish is happy. The Danish feels energetic.
Which is sad, seeing as presumably it's going to get eaten shortly.
Not that one. That one got plucked from obscurity to star in a commercial.
There was a pause. He could hear her drinking water.
Is the cough really better?
I didn't say it was better. I just said it wasn't worse. It's fine. Don't worry about the cough. Tell me about Lucas. What did he say this morning?
He repeated his request.